This is The Takeaway for May 14th. I'm Tanzina Vega. Rural hospitals are closing at alarming rates across the country, and those left are going to great lengths to keep their doors open.
I didn't go to medical school and do all this training to ignore that part of our community, our neighborhoods, to turn our backs on our neighbors.
Why rural hospitals are in trouble and what it means for people in those communities. Plus, a look at how the Trump administration is stoking tensions with Iran, putting the U.S. at odds with European allies. And rifts are appearing within the Trump administration over the growing tariffs with China.
That sort of gets to an inconsistent messaging that they've had from the beginning here. Are the tariffs a means to an end, or are they the end in and of themselves?
And what would SNL star Rachel Dratch be doing if she wasn't an actor?
They asked me when they were writing it, like, what would you want your career to be? So I was like, a therapist, because that's my dream job.
Is it really?
Yes, I really want to be a therapist.
All right, let's hit it, everyone. Across the country, rural hospitals are in trouble.
You have rural hospitals in communities that are economically disadvantaged. People are unemployed. They don't have insurance. It makes it a challenge to stay open when the safety net has gaps and is fragmented and has various components of dysfunction.
According to a 2018 study from the U.S. Government Accountability Office, between 2013 and 2017, 64 rural hospitals closed in the United States. That's more than twice as many closures from the previous period. And most of those closures were in the South, forcing many people to travel even longer distances to get the help they need.
We're in rural central Alabama. It is a lovely community of people, a great place to raise kids or live, but there's been economic depression for decades in a lot of rural Alabama as, you know, different industries have moved out of communities. Sometimes people move out of town for opportunities. Just all of the things that feature rural America, we have them here.
That's Dr. John Waits, a family physician in Centerville, Alabama. For 15 years, Dr. Waits has been working with Cahaba Medical Care, a group of physicians working to provide health care to people in Alabama who may not be able to afford it.
Our mission is to make sure that anybody can afford to use us, or they're not turned away because of inability to pay their health care bills. We just don't want there to be a barrier to someone getting good preventive care or good care for their chronic diseases. I didn't go to medical school and do all this training to ignore that part of our community, our neighborhoods, to turn our backs on our neighbors.
The economic realities of many parts of rural America mean healthcare is increasingly hard to access for many residents.
We've had to be very, very creative with ways to partner with our local hospital and leverage our community health center, and our hospital has leveraged its portfolio to try to stay open and provide a wide range of services to our patients.
And the closure of any hospital can have devastating consequences on a community. To discuss the broad trend of rural hospitals closing and what it means for the people and communities they serve, we have John Gale, a senior researcher with the Maine Rural Health Research Center at the University of Southern Maine. John, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Also with us today is Sarah Jane Tribble, a reporter for Kaiser Health News, who's been reporting on how a rural community in Kansas is grappling with the closure of a local hospital. Sarah Jane, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So let's start with you, Sarah Jane. What have you found in Fort Scott, Kansas? What happened there last December?
So at the end of December, the hospital closed. It had been there for more than a century, 132 years, opened by the Sisters of Mercy nuns. And the community, it was a beloved institution. Its name was everywhere in the community. About 7,800 people live in Fort Scott today, about 14,000 people in the county of Bourbon County. It's about 90 miles south of Kansas City. When the hospital left, they were devastated.
Let's talk about someone that you interviewed. Her name is Pat Wheeler. She's 65 years old, and she's a resident. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
Where's the humanity? You know, what are people like us supposed to do? All of us senior citizens. What are we supposed to do whenever you can't even afford to go to the grocery store to buy a gallon of milk, you know, or a loaf of bread? And the government, they don't care. They don't care at all. They do not care.
Sarah Jane, tell me about Pat Wheeler.
I ran into Pat outside of the local bookstore, Books and Grannies, and she was smoking a cigarette. She helps out there in the store, and she was taking a cigarette break. And when I told her I was working on this series of stories, she immediately began talking. And I think her story really encapsulates the real challenge of rural America today. You know, she is older. She's in her 60s. Her husband is in his 70s. The hospital closed at the end of December, and in January, he needed heart surgery. So she has drained her savings in her bank account, driving him across the border to Missouri, in Joplin, Missouri, to make sure he gets heart surgery and to stay in hotels to care for him and visit him at the hospital when she can't stay in the room with him. And it's really taken a toll on their family income, obviously. And she also highlights something else. There is a lot of poverty in rural America. One out of every four children in Fort Scott live in poverty, according to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And, you know, the GAO report that was mentioned in the intro highlights how median household income in rural America is lower on average than in urban areas.
John, I want to bring you in here because what Sarah Jane is describing, I'm wondering how common it is across the United States.
It's very common. What we find in rural communities is that people tend to be, as Sarah has mentioned, older, sicker, poorer, less well-insured, and with higher rates of chronic illness. And so providing services in that type of environment can be very difficult.
And we heard from Dr. Waits early in the segment, in the opening here, that part of what's happening is also the economic situation is changing in rural America. What other factors, John, are contributing to the situation here?
Well, I think it's a variety of problems. It's a complex issue, is that we have a reimbursement system that doesn't really fit well for a small volume and low volume rural hospitals, that we need an infrastructure in a rural community to provide the basics of emergency care, urgent care, primary care, long-term care services, and to some and inpatient care. And so it's hard under the current payment models, which are really oriented towards bigger facilities with that are able to spread their fixed costs around. And so we have that problem of a reimbursement system that doesn't recognize the realities of delivering care in a rural community. The other part that we get is some unusual competition. It's not unusual to find different types of providers, critical access hospitals, federally qualified health centers, all in the same community but not really working as well together as they might. There are some great examples where they do work together but many where they don't. And so there are only so many resources in a rural community. And then we have to figure out how to get those hospitals and help those hospitals to deliver the care that communities and members of the community need. So do they get their primary care? Can young women deliver children in the area? Can we take care of their chronic diseases, diabetes, hypertension? If they have a substance use problem, can they get care for that? Can they get their depression treated? So it's really trying to develop a system of care. And in many ways, the traditional models of an inpatient service is changing. So I think we have to be more creative in using technology and other opportunities to us to deliver care.
And Sarah Jane, I want to ask you a little bit about sort of pivoting off of what John just said there, because the example that we heard earlier, Pat Wheeler's example, is one thing, but there are a series of other types of illnesses and reasons why people would seek medical care. How difficult is it to actually get to hospitals in places like Fort Scott? The actual distance. And then as a result of that, what ends up happening? Are people dying? Are they not getting the care that they need?
It's a complicated scenario. It's a simple question, but it's a complicated scenario depending on where the hospital closure happens. In Fort Scott, where I've taken three visits this year, we're following Kaiser Health News and NPR are following this community for the next year. This hospital is about 30 miles away from a critical access hospital, and it's also about 30 miles away from another hospital. What Rita Baker, the president of the hospital, found and what she told me was that there was a tremendous amount of what they call out-migration. Patients were, when they sought care like MRIs or specialist care, they would bypass the local hospital and drive up to Kansas City, 90 miles away. It's a four-lane highway, and you can get there in an hour and a half easy, 75 miles an hour. So if they had optional care, they often outmigrated past the community. The challenge was the emergency care. Emergency care services were decreasing. The number of people using that ED were decreasing over the last few years. Rita went out of her way to make sure they had a contract with a hospital 30 miles away to keep that emergency services open for the next 2 years. And she also made sure that the outpatient clinics that the hospital ran were taken over by a federally qualified healthcare center that's in southeastern Kansas. Rita herself has been part of the community and has been running part of the hospital. She was a staff nurse starting back in 1981. So she has a big heart for the community, and she's taken a lot of criticism in the community since the hospital closed, but she tried to set up what she thought was an ideal model of care.
John, let's talk a little bit about the national picture here throughout rural America and the country. Are these situations similar? Is it difficult for people to actually get to the healthcare that they need? And then how much is the healthcare costing? Is it more expensive for people in rural communities?
It's a good question. It depends. In terms of getting to other sources of care, it really depends. If an individual or family has a car that's functional and they have the resources to drive and they can afford the time away from work, then they can get to those other services. What happens to those people that don't have a license, can no longer drive, don't have a functional car, or can't afford to take the time off or take a day off from work to drive an hour and a half each way to get care? They're the people that are left in the community, and that makes a declining population for the hospitals. So we are seeing a lot of this nationally. The numbers have been anywhere from 400 to 600 hospitals might be at risk for foreclosure in the coming years. And so the question really becomes, how do we develop a system that the local hospital can't deliver everything that's needed? There are some things that are because of fixed costs or because of the technology requirements. You probably shouldn't and can't do viably or economically at a small hospital. But how do you work with the nearby hospitals to get the things that they need but make sure the other services stay in the community? And that becomes a challenge.
Sarah, we have 1 minute left. I just want to make sure we get Sarah in here. Sarah, is there anything that can be done to help rural communities at the policy level? We've got less than a minute left.
Yes, I think that there are some proposals in Congress, some shifts in Medicare payment funding. Congress had made some efforts when there's a big swath of hospital closures across the country, I think in the 1980s, 1990s. So they can make some more changes now to Medicare payments and other things.
Sarah Jane Tribble is a reporter for Kaiser Health News, and John Gale is a senior researcher with the Maine Rural Health Research Center at the University of Southern Maine. Sarah and John, we appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last week, U.S. trade negotiations with China broke down abruptly, just as all signs had been pointing to an imminent deal.
But we had a deal with China. It was 95% there. And then my representatives, as you know, Secretary Mnuchin and Bob Lighthizer, Ambassador Lighthizer, they went to China and they were told the things that were fully agreed to, we're not going to get anymore. They're going to unagree to them. That's not acceptable. I said, good, that's fine. Put on the tariffs.
President Trump there describing the breakdown and new tariffs on Chinese goods. Then Monday, China announced its own retaliatory efforts, promising that they'd, quote, never surrender in the standoff with the United States. But President Trump still thinks his administration has the upper hand and is threatening even more tariffs if China refuses to back down.
We have the right to do another $325 billion at 25% in additional tariffs. That is a tremendous amount of money that would come into our country. I have not made that decision yet.
Alex Lawson is with us. He's Law 360's senior reporter on international trade and the co-host of the Pro Se podcast. Alex, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much, Denzina.
Let's break this down because we have both sides, as we just said, taking shots. It seems to be escalating.
Yeah.
Is there any wiggle room for continued negotiations at this point?
The way that both sides have structured this sort of new escalation of tariffs, they have allowed for a period of time, a few weeks, where they might be able to avoid this latest hit. China's retaliation, which was announced on Monday, yesterday, doesn't go into effect until June 1. The U.S. tariff increase that was announced on Friday, that applies to goods that left China starting on May 10th. So if you take the time on the water, it'll be a couple of weeks. So there is some time here. There's literally time to do it, but there's been time to do it. And they've gotten no closer basically to where they were in December. And now we're here in middle of May. So the prospects are not exactly bright.
And the tariffs, I mean, we see each side seems to keep wanting to outdo the other, right?
Yeah.
So let's look at what effect China's tariffs could have on our economy here in the States.
It's been a little bit mixed in terms of both sides have been strategic in the way they deploy them because they want to make a strong statement, but they don't want to throw their respective economies into chaos. But what we can say so far is that most of China's retaliation has focused on the U.S. farming sector, and the tariff increases that were announced yesterday focus on beef, pork, several commodities, corn, wheat, other things. And those are things that really send shockwaves through middle America. The Trump administration has tried to slide in and say, oh, don't worry, we're collecting tariffs and we'll use that money to bail you out. They've started to do that. The farmers who are receiving that aid have expressed a little bit of discomfort with the way it's being done. They, of course, would just rather do business on their normal course. But the discomfort, such as it is going to get a lot more pointed if we continue along this path of escalation.
And of course, as we mentioned, the president, President Trump, is promising even more tariffs. What would those look like?
Well, that would sort of move us across the Rubicon and into a new phase of this, because at the beginning of this whole U.S.-China tariff escalation that we have on our hands, the U.S. sort of chose to target a lot of industrial goods like steel parts that would are sort of either used in machinery or they're used to make other things. You're far from the point of purchase is what I'm saying. But now both this escalation that was announced on Friday and if these new tariffs take effect, you're going to see it on consumer products. And those are the types of products where we, the consumers, will feel more of those price effects because we are sort of there are fewer go-betweens in the supply chain, right? It's just like this is the product. Now we have to put it on the shelf. It's a matter of time before companies start to raise their prices to absorb that hit. Those get passed on to U.S. consumers, despite what the president continues to say. And that's sort of what we're facing here, if that takes effect.
Alex, this morning, the president has been tweeting quite a bit. We selected one of his tweets to have you sort of analyze. And here's what he just won. But we can go
okay.
Further.
Yes.
He says here, in 1 year, tariffs have rebuilt our steel industry. It is booming. We placed a 25% tariff on dumped steel from China and other countries, and now we have a big and growing industry. Is that statement accurate from the president?
It kind of depends on which figures you're looking at. Steel productivity is generally up, though it's not always immediately clear whether or not you can attribute that to the tariffs or whether this is the normal flow of business. Steel employment is remaining mostly flat, a couple of maybe pockets of increase or decrease here or there. I think what it glides past, though, even to the extent that tariffs have helped the steel industry with regard to people who make steel, right, it looks past the detrimental effects that it is having on the purchasers of steel because tariffs create de facto monopolies. It reduces where you can buy your steel from, and it's raised costs for companies that use the steel to make other things, and that has effects on those supply chains. So it's even if it's fair to say that tariffs have helped steel in certain aspects, it's only painting part of the picture with regard to whether the policy is sound or not.
Over the weekend, we had the president's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, talk about the effect of these tariffs on Fox News. Let's take a listen to what he has to say, because it feels like it's in direct opposition to what the president is saying.
It's not China that pays tariffs. It's the American importers, the American companies that pay what in effect is a tax increase and oftentimes passes it on to U.S. consumers.
Fair enough. In fact, both sides will pay. Both sides will pay in these things.
Alex, how do you interpret that, what Kudlow's saying there?
They're trying to thread an interesting needle here, which is, it is factually the case that when things are brought into the country, importers literally pay the tariffs. It's true that sometimes maybe the exporting partner might rebate you or recoup you. That is a private transaction. It happens in different ways all the time. But it's true that the importers pay the taxes, pay tariffs. I think what Kudlow is trying to say is that China will be paying, in quotes, just in terms of overall GDP losses down the line. Now, that is not the same as paying a tariff, but like paying the price for, I think, is what they're trying to say. And that is true. There's an IMF study that suggests that the tariffs will reduce China's GDP by quite a lot over the long run. But I think what that interview really revealed was an interesting schism inside the White House, because even if Kudlow is willing to say, yes, U.S. customers, U.S. businesses are bearing the burden of these tariffs, that's just something that needs to happen to get sort of longer term wins out of China. But that's not what Trump has said. Trump has sort of in tweets and other statements said, it's not just that tariffs are, you know, a bitter medicine that we have to swallow now. I like doing the tariffs. The tariffs are a sort of uniformly good thing. You're starting to see people like Kudlow, people like Mnuchin differ from him on that. And that sort of gets to an inconsistent messaging that they've had from the beginning here. Are the tariffs a means to an end, or are they the end in and of themselves?
I want to ask you a question about the markets. We know that the markets are not the economy exactly,
yeah.
But how are markets reacting to this? And ultimately, what does that tell us going forward?
I think the markets are reacting badly. I think the Dow was down 600 or so points yesterday. And that is the only, I mean, I never like to overreact too much to that. However, it's not unimportant because Trump cares about it a lot. He is forever using the stock market as a barometer for whether or not his policies are good. Many people will tell you that is not the way to conduct economic policy, but that's an issue for another day. The only thing would be if it continues in those kind of triple digit losses over a long enough time, he might, I emphasize, might feel some pressure to take a softer line with China. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but only because he puts so much stock in the market.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right. And so that would be the reason to keep watching that. The idea that if Wall Street keeps responding so poorly, he might start to listen, but that's no guarantee.
Alex Lawson is Law360's senior reporter on international trade and the co-host of Law360's Pro Se podcast. Alex, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The White House is reviewing a plan that could send up to 120,000 troops to the Middle East in preparation for a possible conflict with Iran. Administration officials said the plans are preliminary and do not call for a land invasion. But they do represent the hardline views of National Security Advisor John Bolton, who has advocated for preemptive strikes against Iran in the past. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo canceled a planned trip to Moscow on Monday, flying instead to Brussels to meet with foreign ministers from the European Union. Pompeo made the unexpected decision in the hopes of signaling cooperation between the U.S. and European allies over their relations with Iran. The Trump administration currently finds itself at odds with European leaders. While the U.S. has been stoking tensions with Iran's government, the European Union remains focused on preserving the Iran nuclear deal that President Trump walked away from last year. With us, we have Farnaz Fasihi, a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Farnaz.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So a lot to unpack today. Let's start with the significance of these preliminary military plans that prepare for the possibility of sending more troops to the Middle East. What are your thoughts on that, Farnaz?
It seems that for the past week that Washington is steadily increasing its rhetoric, war rhetoric on Iran. We first heard of news that warships were heading to the Persian Gulf near Iran. Last night, there's news in the New York Times that the Trump administration is planning for a conflict and the potential of sending 120,000 troops to the Middle East. These are all very alarming. They're alarming not because necessarily we're going to invade Iran or attack Iran, but the fact that the potential of a conflict exists, and the fact that there's a lot of variables in the Middle East, a lot of things that could happen unpredictably, tensions between the Revolutionary Guards and U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf. We've had that happen in the past. Iranian proxies in Iraq or Syria or elsewhere doing something that the U.S. deems as a threat or a provocation. Tensions are steadily escalating.
Farnaz, we know that National Security Advisor John Bolton has a long history of taking a pretty hawkish stance when it comes to Iran. Where do you see his position going on this?
John Bolton has been open about wanting regime change in Iran before he joined the administration. He has written op-eds about it. He has close ties to an Iranian opposition group that is a cult and that it was on the U.S. and European terrorist list. Therefore, as far as the hawkish stance of this administration, what we're seeing right now very much represents Mr. Bolton's views. Now, at the same time, this administration, including Mr. Bolton, has also said that our policy is not war with Iran. As we're hearing that war plans are being drawn and they're making contingency plans for a potential conflict with Iran, we have to also remember that this administration pretty much had a similar strategy with North Korea when we thought that we might be going to war with North Korea about 2 years ago. So this might also be part of a strategy to really try to pressure Iran psychologically together with economic sanctions to bring it to the negotiating table.
What options does the United States have if the EU doesn't back the Trump administration's handling of Iran, which so far it looks like they're not on the same page?
Europe and the U.S. have been divided on their Iran policy, especially when it comes to the nuclear deal and especially when it comes to potential conflict. We saw that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a surprise visit to Brussels as the European foreign ministers were meeting right before he got there. Even without this news of a contingency war plans, Europe was sounding the alarm bells of these positions that Washington is taking is too hardline, that we do not want any conflict with Iran and we're not on board with another war in the Middle East, especially with Iran. So if Mr. Pompeo's goal was to go to Brussels and convince Europe of the threats and provocations from Iran, that didn't seem to really work out because the Europeans came out saying that we're not on the same page at all and we remain committed to the nuclear deal. I think one thing we need to remember is that this conflict with Iran is really because of the Trump administration's unilateral decision to exit the Iran deal, while the UN, the Atomic Agency, the Europeans, everyone is saying that Iran remains committed to the deal.
We've seen earlier this month that Iran's president has announced that he was walking away from several parts of the Iran nuclear deal. Where does this leave the deal?
The deal as a whole is still intact. Iran has announced that it was exiting two of the provisions of the deal, but those don't have to do with starting nuclear enrichment or opening up the nuclear reactors. Under the deal, Iran has stopped enriching uranium. It has gotten rid of its existing stockpile, and it has shut down the Iraq nuclear plant, which was where much of this activity was taking place. So despite the fact that they've announced this in reaction to Washington's decision and in reaction to Europe not being able to offer them much sanctions relief, the sanctions on Iran's oil sales, and particularly the Trump administration's decision not to give waivers to countries that were importing Iran's oil, despite the sanctions, really made Iran want to do something in reaction to say, well, we're not going to remain committed if you don't offer us what we thought we were going to get out of the deal.
Over the weekend, there were two Saudi oil tankers that were damaged in the Gulf. What do we know about that situation, Farnaz?
We don't have much details on who carried out what happened. The Saudis and the Emiratis have said that this was an act of sabotage, but we don't really have any details on who did it and who's responsible. But this all adds to the tensions in the Persian Gulf, right? I mean, even if the perception is that it could be Iran or proxies that are attached to Iran, this escalates things. You know, it adds that if we take everything that's happened in the past week, we also see that the focus of these tensions is the Persian Gulf, not necessarily Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Lebanon, where the U.S. claims that Iran is Iran's proxies and militia and groups that are funded and supported by Iran might attack U.S. troops. We haven't really seen that happen But what we're seeing is a lot of focus on the activity within the waters of the Persian Gulf.
Farnaz Fasihi is a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Farnaz.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sorry I'm late. There was an accident on the 405. From the looks of it, there may have been fatalities. You gotta assume that when they bring out the jaws of life.
Always there to tell you about a new disease, a car accident, or killer bees. You beg her to spare you, Debbie, please, but you can't stop Debbie Downer.
That may be what comes to mind when you think of comedian Rachel Dratch. She was on Saturday Night Live from 1999 to 2006 as Debbie Downer and countless other characters. She's also had roles on nearly any comedy show you can think of, from 30 Rock to Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt to Bob's Burgers and The Simpsons. Her latest work is a reunion with many of the women she worked with on SNL and with whom she's been friends for years. Here's a scene from the new movie, Wine Country.
Why are you saying feedback all the time?
Oh, it's this thing I've been doing in my practice. It just provides an emotional buffer. So rather than just launch into your take on something or just give advice, you say, may I offer you some feedback?
May I offer you some feedback?
Offer you some feedback.
Feedback.
Ready for some feedback.
Ready for some feedback.
Feedback.
Ready for some feedback.
Ooh, that was good.
Rachel Dratch there, along with the rest of the ensemble cast of the new Netflix film Wine Country, including director Amy Poehler. The movie follows a group of middle-aged women on a birthday trip to Napa, celebrating the 50th birthday of Rachel Dratch's character. The trip was based on a real, if less drama-filled, trip to celebrate Rachel Dratch's actual 50th several years ago. The resulting film is an ode to female friendship and a look at the complexities of middle age. I sat down with Rachel to talk about the film and her life in comedy, starting with her role in Wine Country as a woman in denial about her age.
I played a therapist who, I would want to be a therapist if I weren't an actor. So they asked me when they were writing it, like, what would you want your career to be? So I was like, a therapist, because that's my dream job.
Is it really?
Yes, I really want to be a therapist.
Why?
Because I just like, you know, trying to figure people. I mean, it's kind of related to acting, I guess, but one is the dark side of the coin and the other is the more fun side. But yeah, I just like, you know, sort of like psychoanalyzing people and figuring out what makes people tick and all that. So
your character psychoanalyzed yourself essentially in the film when you have this moment. I think I don't want to give too much away.
Meltdown.
But there's a meltdown moment. And tell us, was it a meltdown or was it an epiphany?
Yeah, good question. Well, I think just all my denial like breaks down and I'm just like, you know, this is it. Like, let's just go live for the moment. And, you know, I don't know. There's a raccoon mentioned. I mean, you got to see the movie. But
A family of raccoons.
Help me see the light. Yes. And maybe that will work for you too, listeners. If you are having a crisis, you have to look into the eye of a raccoon.
One of the scenes in the movie that stood out to me was the tarot card reader. I find it fascinating. Do you really believe in that stuff in real life? Or tell me where that came in.
Good question. Glad you asked this hard-hitting tarot question. No, so a couple things. One is that's a moment from the real trip that was the most close to the real trip.
Okay.
Like, you know, because a lot of stuff we took liberties. There really was a tarot card reader that Amy had come to the house. And she came and you would think a tarot reader was going to be all like, oh, airy fairy and like, let's talk spirituality. But this woman was like really cranky and just not what you would expect for a tarot reader. And so like at one point in real life, Paula was like, oh, that'd make a cool tattoo. And the woman's like, please don't touch the cards. Like, so that they really put her, Cherry Jones plays her in the movie. That's the closest thing. Now, do I believe in that? Well, I've had some eerie experiences with the psychic world. Yes. A friend took me to a channeler on my 43rd birthday.
And what does a channeler do?
A channeler, so I didn't know this either, but a channeler is someone who channels a spirit that gives you your whatever, your fortune, your, I don't know what you want to call it.
Okay.
Your feedback. And so I went to this woman and she greeted me like talking normally and everything. And then you sit down and then she all of a sudden like looks down and then she pops her head up and she's like, oh, hello, it is very good to see you. Oh, now I'm talking in this accent. I mean, she didn't say that. But she started talking in this sort of you know, non-discriminate accent, indiscriminate. Anyway, anyway, long story short, she told me that I was going to meet someone in 3 to 6 months and that I was going to have one child. Okay, so I'm 43 and I'm thinking like, you know, I bet she says that to every chick who comes in here. But then I did meet a man. I met someone four months later, and then I had a surprise pregnancy when I was almost 44. Like, it was like the prophecy came true. And I had my child when I was 44, and the channeler told me that was going to happen. So I would, that was like that's my most like wow thing.
I need your channeler's number.
I know a lot of people say, no, I've sent other people to her because everyone else is, they haven't had the same like earth shattering. So, but I will give you the name.
I wanted to ask you, we did ask for our listeners to see if they had any questions for you. So we have a couple from them.
Okay.
One of our listeners tweeted saying, do you feel more comfortable in a particular kind of role?
Okay. Yes. Now I feel really comfortable doing like broad, wacky SNL type stuff. Like that's where I feel like I'm in my wheelhouse. But you know, I was a drama major back in the day, so I've had training, as it were, but I always veered towards the comedy parts. Like I think I had a part in Miss Julie in college. I wasn't Miss Julie, but I was like that maid person. I was probably terrible. Like I'm just not good at the drama. So, but for me, like anything comedy related is fun for me. I mean, I started in theater in Second City and all that. I love doing live theater, but yeah, anything funny is my jam.
Are you surprised by any direction that your career has taken so far?
You know, I don't know, like showbiz is such a, I need a cigarette hanging on. Showbiz is a crazy roller coaster. I think like, you know, going to acting, like the first step is you have to adjust your brain to being comfortable with uncertainty, which, you know, if you were in a sort of a more regular profession, you just do the steps to get the job and then that can be your career for life. This is much more up and down, but once you sort of learn to relax into that and know something will come along, then like your life is a lot happier. You're not stressing on all the time. So that's the point that I'm at. I mean, it definitely, you know, took years to get to that point, I would say.
So what about when it comes to being a successful woman in this field? I mean, going back to Wine Country, having a film focused on women and women of your age is rare. Were you worried that it wouldn't resonate because it wasn't, you know, 20-something-year-olds?
I mean, when I was growing up, there were all sorts of movies that featured women. I remember, like, Bette Midler was in all these. She was starred in all these movies. And, like I remember, whatever, 9 to 5 was, like, a giant hit when I was little. And, like,
I remember that,
like,
was
women's
huge
stories. It wasn't, well, maybe because I was little and I was oblivious. But there wasn't anything. It's a woman's movie. It was just, like, this movie's a hit, you know? So that's kind of how I grew up. Like, I watched the original seasons of SNL, and I wasn't thinking, like, these women are funny, too. I was just like, there's Gilda Radner doing Roseanne, Roseanne, there's Bill Murray. So I don't know where that comes on to you of this thing of, like, separating out women and men. But I didn't grow up thinking that, so I still don't really think that way. But I understand it's, like, more rare to see a movie featuring big cast of women, I guess.
And also just women of a certain age. Like that, yes. that you don't often see that. I haven't seen them as much as I think I'd like to. So.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm in utter denial. I'm like, it's not about our age.
Kind of
nothing about our age in this. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
May I offer you some feedback?
You may.
Rachel Dratch is a comedian, author, and star of the new Netflix film, Wine Country. Rachel, we really appreciate you joining the show. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.